Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with New Orleans artist Alex Beard about his beautiful new book, A Brush with Nature, Abstract Realism and the Painting of Life. We'll also hear from Colleen Mooney, who's working on organizing a chapter of Sisters in Crime in New Orleans. And I'll have a recap of the recent Writers Resist event. Beard has led a life of art and adventure. Inspired by childhood visits to his uncle's farm in Africa, he's traveled the world looking for and finding artistic inspiration. If you've visited his gallery on Julia Street, you've seen his gorgeous ink drawings and oil paintings of wildlife, created in a style that is recognizably, wonderfully his own. And if you've been to a bookstore, you've seen his charming children's books in the trilogy Tales from the Watering Hole, which includes The Jungle Grapevine, Monkey See, Monkey Draw, and Crocodile Tears. And now we have a gorgeous book of his art, A Brush with Nature, Abstract Naturalism, and the Painting of Life. Alex Beard, I'm so happy to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
I'm so happy to be here. It's always a pleasure to be in your company.
Oh, this book is so gorgeous. It's hard to know where to begin.
At the beginning.
The very beginning. So what made you think the time was right for a book like this?
I'd been asked by a few people to do a coffee table book of my more complex, naturalist, abstract, more adult paintings. And for a while, I was reluctant to do it because I'm not the guy who just sticks paintings in a book, throws his name on the cover, and hopes that that's enough. I think it's presumptuous, frankly. So I thought for a while about how to put together a book of my work where I could have a greater purpose to it than just showing off. And I'm interested in the way in nature that things intrinsically move. I'm interested in the mathematics behind it, things like the divine proportion and Fibonacci's exponential growth system, why the spiral in the seashell is the same shape as the arms of the entire galaxy, and the history of how we perceive ourselves in relationship to our surroundings and the artist's role in that. And that all sounds rather heady and gobbledygooky. But at the end of the day, it's the realm in which I operate when making my art. So I thought that this book, A Brush with Nature, would be a good vehicle for me to explain what I'm doing.
Well, I have to say, you don't usually find equations in a coffee table book.
No, that's right.
In the author's own handwriting, I think. So.
Well, the irony of that is that I'm pretty bad at math.
I know. That's what was so funny about this.
So mathematics, I think, is generally taught as a quantitative device. 2 + 2 = 4. How do you do your taxes? But it can also be viewed as a qualitative device, as in a language by which humans have used to explain our place in the universe and the order of the chaos that surrounds us. Now, that, of course, applies to a composition for an artwork as well, right? I mean, you're starting, if you're talking about something that's in a rectangle, which most paintings are, you're starting something which is two-dimensional, and you're adding dimensions to it, and you're creating a universe with depth and movement, which was ultimately paralleling the universe in which we live. So there's a leap there between explaining what that means in the general and then seeing it in the tactile. And I wanted this book to be a means where I could explain to you where the math came from in, is what I was hoping, a lay fashion. And then build the art in the book from the beginning to the end where you can see what I'm talking about play out. Start very simply and work to much more complex.
It reminded me of something I read once about Walter Anderson, that he had read this book that had the 7 basic patterns in nature, and that totally informed the rest of his work going forward, that he would use those 7 patterns, spirals, swerves, you know. It was really interesting to have you explain this.
Well, I'm a big fan of Walter Anderson's, first of all. I think that the way that he lived his life was very interesting, of course, but the work that he made was extraordinary. And so I am a liberal advocate of his, especially, and this will sound a little tangential, but how he began the process of taking the rigidity of M.C. Escher's complex work and making it a little more organic. And I'm talking about things like the cross-hatchings in his waves and the feather patterns in his birds and the scales in his fish, where they have a fabulous design element to them, which implies movement because it's, as you say, taking the basic elements that we find in nature.
And like Walter Anderson, you get out in the world you paint.
I do.
You've spent a lot of time doing that.
As much as I possibly can. For lots of reasons. The first, most obvious being that if you're going to paint nature, you better get out into nature. The second being, if you want to think about your place in the universe, best to get out of your own way into a place, in my case, I particularly like going to Africa, but all over the place, really, right? I mean, you can go into the woods, go down to the marsh and go duck hunting on an early morning, and you get the same experience. And it's about understanding the larger system into which you or me or any of us are integral but small parts. You have a different perspective on your place in the universe when you're standing beneath a starry sky and looking up at the infinite void than you do sitting in front of a computer screen only in an echo chamber.
Well, I loved when you talked about being in Africa and how in the afternoon when it's really hot, people would go and take naps, but you would paint.
Yeah, correct. So, well, that's how I rest.
I'm sure. So I'm curious, you know, did it make you think about the book itself as an art object when you were putting this together?
Yeah, absolutely.
I see this beautiful half slipcase, you know, and the cover is so beautifully printed. So what did it do for you in terms of books, you know, because you've come from children's books, which are very bright and cheerful and have this kind of flow, to this big book?
Yeah, I have been interested in the making of books for a long time. All the way back when I was in college, I went to the School and Museum of Fine Arts in Boston and studied under a guy there named Carl Sesto, who, as far as I know, is still there, who's a great traditional bookmaking master. Right? How does the press work? All that. And so I think in terms often of laying out my thoughts as a book, whether it's for a children's parable or getting into something like, you know, the history of a whole school of art, like I'm doing here. And there needs to be a flow to it. In the same way that an individual painting needs to have movement, so too does the book. You need to think a little bit about how to make that happen. Every page can't look the same or else the viewer's interest gets lost. And you can't keep saying the same thing again and again or else it's just a stack of Xeroxes.
True.
Right? So as a result, every page needs to have a raison d'etre. Just as in a painting, you can have a fabulous painting that's great except for the bottom right-hand corner, which is clunky and sloppy, and the whole painting sucks. Same too with the book.
And you obviously love your materials. I mean, there are those wonderful photographs of ink bottles, and brushes, and tubes of paint in this book.
Well, I really wanted to open up the closet of secrets. I did not think it was necessary to be a magician as well as an artist. I'm not worried that anybody will copy me. And I'm not worried that people will take the pieces that I put out in forms like this in books and do things other than their intent to them. Right? So none of those things concern me. I'm not competitive in that way. So as a result, I feel like the people who like my work should be entitled to know how I make it and how I think about it. And that hopefully will help inform them better as to what I'm making and what I'm getting at. Because ultimately it should be a conversation between me and the public as opposed to just between me and me. That's one of the problems of the art world is that it's become so self-referential.
And that's why you work in an open studio, right?
Correct.
You know?
Absolutely.
Now, I'm also curious, you said that you moved to New Orleans because you didn't want to move to Calcutta.
That's true.
So, what has the city given to you over time? You're home now, I think.
Yeah, no, I love New Orleans, and I could never live anywhere else. I mean, I visit lots of places. I was born and raised in New York City, so as a result, I'm always also sort of a New Yorker. Most of my family's still there, and, you know, the JetBlue jitney back and forth makes it easy to accommodate. But I definitely am a New Orleanian. I'm married to a Louisianian. I have two children born in New Orleans. I live in the Garden District. My business is run out of Julia Street. Now, all those are just things, statistics on a piece of paper, right? The reality of why I live in New Orleans is because we are a unique environment, certainly in the United States, where we're a little Caribbean, we're a little Southern, we're a little Spanish, we're a little French, we're a little African, we're a little everything. I happen to like that. I also like it that we have the overtures of some of the better qualities of a banana republic.
You like that.
Okay. Oh, I love it. I'm not talking about the characteristics that we don't like about the idea of a banana republic. But I was sitting last night on my porch in the rain with a friend of mine talking about life and the universe and everything. And it was just a random Monday evening, listening to the rain through the crepe myrtles. Right? I mean, that doesn't happen in New York. There's a pace to the place that I like. I'm also particularly fond of the people who live here. Those who are from here, multi-generationally, those who just showed up a couple of weeks ago. And part of it is that we all live here on purpose.
That's a city of intention.
It is really a city of intention. And that then translates into how we lead the lives that we live here too. Because we get up with something to do. And most of the rest of the world, you come up with an idea and people say to you, well, that sounds really expensive. Or, why would you bother? Or, yeah, that sounds great. Show me when you're done. Here in New Orleans, you come up with an idea and people start coming out of the woodwork saying, oh, that sounds great. I'd love to participate. What can we do together? And that is that's something that I think the rest of the world could use a little more of.
I know. We're very, very lucky to live here.
Correct. In fact, I think it's possible that we in New Orleans, after having come through Katrina, rebuilt ourselves and moving forward, need to think of ourselves as a beacon of hope for a world which is shattering. That we need to, in a way, put ourselves out there as one of the successful models for all of the faults that we have. And obviously, we know that we have plenty. But we still speak to each other on our front porches.
In the rain.
In the rain.
About life, the universe, and everything.
The universe and everything. And we're not afraid of it, nor are we afraid of the consequences of it.
Right.
And we might find ourselves in an interesting position moving forward as New Orleanians.
Oh, I hope so. I think so.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Alex Beard, whose beautiful new book is A Brush with Nature, Abstract Naturalism, and the Painting of Life. You can find his book in local bookstores, visit alexbeardstudio.com, or visit his gallery at 608 Julia Street. Alex, thank you so much.
It is always such a pleasure to be here with you, and we always have such interesting conversations, usually not necessarily about the thing we set out to talk about in the first place. I love it.
Thanks. Colleen Mooney is the author of two mysteries set in New Orleans, Rescued by a Kiss and the wonderfully titled Dead and Breakfast. A third, Drive Through Murder, is forthcoming. Today we'll be talking about one of her new projects, founding a chapter of Sisters in Crime right here in New Orleans. Colleen Mooney, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hello, Susan. Thank you for having me.
Now, you are a busy woman, and you like to do lots of different things. You like scuba diving, you like sailing. You're the director of Schnauzer Rescue in Louisiana. So what made you think it was time to add something new?
I have no idea. It was a momentary loss of memory, I guess. I had attended BushaCon this past one in September, and I met the Sisters in Crime there and asked, why don't we have a chapter in New Orleans? And they thought that was an excellent idea. So they said, and you should do it, Colleen. And I told them, please, I can't take on anything else until the first of the year. And lo and behold, they remembered and called me after the first of the year.
Uh-oh. Well, that'll teach you.
That will.
But Sisters in Crime is an amazing group. It's 30 years old. So tell us a little bit about, you know, why you're attracted to it, why you think we need it.
Well, I'm attempting to get it together, and I have a lot of interest, mainly because Sisters in Crime was founded at a writers' conference 30 years ago, where a bunch of women were sitting around wondering, Why aren't we getting the reviews? Reviews equal money. Most of those were going to the men. So they started thinking more and more, and then they had some more women concerned about the graphic violence at the time written in a lot of mysteries and books. And so the women got together and formed Sisters in Crime to benefit the business of women in writing. We have a lot of good writers, so we need to help each other, and that's how it was formed.
And one of the great godmothers of Sisters in Crime was Sarah Paretsky, who won the Pinkley Prize this year for body of work. And she talked about that as one of the things she felt she'd done in her life that was most important.
Oh, absolutely. I think women tend not to help each other like we should. And I'm drawn to this group because they are very embracing. They welcome you before you even join. They're happy to help you. So I've been impressed with their attitude towards each other.
So what sorts of programs are you looking to have? What are you looking forward to getting out of this group?
There's a mentoring program. There are several different things. We have a laundry list, really, of benefits. If you wanted to go to the Sisters in Crime.org website. But mainly, we have a speakers bureau. They provide us with speakers here to come to meetings. They will do a monthly drawing. They award a library once a month of $1,000. Also, they have bookstore awards monthly of $250. So they pick independent bookstores and award them $250 to add books to their inventory, and also the same with the libraries. But that's $1,000 a month. So they do a lot of good works there. They have a wonderful quarterly newsletter that has a lot of information for mystery writers and crime writers on every type of topic you can think of, from how poisons affect people and which ones, if you were going to use one, which one you should use not to get caught.
Of course.
To every kind of crime. They have a police academy also, a writer's police academy, and that's promoted in the newsletter, and it's once a year in Wisconsin.
Well, one of the things that I think is fascinating is that mystery writers need to know all these things about forensics, about weapons, about law enforcement. I mean, there's some real nitty-gritty information that mystery writers have to get right.
That's correct. And it varies from state to state. And so there is a website that helps us out, Sisters in Crime. We have links to all different types of resources. There's a resource page for us, sending us to different states. If you're writing in, say, North Carolina or California, their criminologists do things differently at a crime scene, and the forensics are different from state to state. So that helps the writer. If you're not familiar with that state, it will help you get your facts correct.
The other thing I think is interesting about Sisters in Crime is that they do accept men.
Absolutely, yes. It is open to both men and women. We have about 3,600 members in 48 chapters across the country. About 10% of that are men. Mm-hmm. But we do welcome them.
And what do you think about women's organizations? What do you get out of a group like this? Because it's a lot of work to start one and keep it going.
It is, but I like being involved in things, and I am of the mindset that if you want to get something out of a group or an effort or a membership, then you have to be able and willing to put forth yourself and give of it, too, in order to get stuff back.
So what are the steps? You can't just say, oh, here we are, we're Sisters in Crime. There are a lot of, you know, hoops to jump through to get this chapter going.
Yes, there are, but Sisters in Crime is very helpful in that area. They have a guideline set up on the website on how to start a chapter, and I have two other members from another writers group here who are helping. They are board members of that group, so I'm very fortunate to have people willing to help me who have set up other organizations. So that's a big plus. And we're following the guidelines, and that's the reason for our first meeting, is to see if there's enough interest to generate going forward with the chapter.
And one thing we should stress is that Sisters in Crime has two different kinds of memberships. You know, you can be a writer, but you can also just be someone who loves mystery fiction.
That's correct. We are open to fans of mystery, in addition to mystery writers, aspiring writers, librarians, publishers. We have pretty much of an open door policy.
So sign me up. So let's say, when is your first meeting?
January 31st is a Tuesday evening at 7 to 8:30. We're meeting at the East Jefferson Regional Library at 4747 West Napoleon Avenue in Metairie.
And anyone can come.
Everyone is invited who has an interest in mystery.
And then you're going to have three different follow-up meetings, Saturday, March 4th at 1, Thursday, April 6th, and Wednesday, May 3rd. Both of those are at 7. And that's all at the East Bank Regional Library. So we'll remind people of those as the time gets closer.
I would greatly appreciate that, Susan.
We've been talking with mystery writer Colleen Mooney, who's starting a Sisters in Crime chapter right here in New Orleans. Colleen, thanks so much, and come back and tell us how it goes.
I will. And thank you so much for having me.
James Baldwin said it best. You think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read. It was books that taught me that the things that tormented me most were the very things that connected me with all the people who were alive, who had ever been alive. One thing's for sure. No one felt alone in pain and heartbreak at the recent Writers' Resist event on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, and James Baldwin's work was duly celebrated. A couple of hundred folks crowded into the Art Garage on St. Claude Avenue to hear writers read works that inspired them as citizens, as writers, as activists. It was a lovely and stirring reminder of how literature at its very best often gives us heart and hope for the struggles of life. Students began the reading, starting with What I Pledge Allegiance To by Kiese Layman, read by Joe Geringer of Loyola, Alexandria Goulden of Lusher, and Gloria Jordan and Lexi Roussel of NOCA. And I love the students from Big Class, Quincy and Alexis and Sonny, reading their letters to President Obama and President Trump. You can pre-order their book at bigclass.org. Later on, poet Carolyn Hembree did an amazing choral reading of Joy Harjo's Trickster with her UNO students. What was particularly moving was the range of the subjects and time periods. Thomas Beller drew from accounts of Mussolini's rise to power, talking about cordoned off journalists watching the dictator lie about winning tennis games, all from Italy from Within by Richard Masick. Jamie Attenberg read from Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, that passage in which Dumbledore cautions his students, "Remember, Cedric, remember if the time should come when you have to make a choice between what is right and what is easy. Remember what happened to a boy who was good and kind and brave because he strayed across the path of Lord Voldemort. Remember Cedric Diggory." Katie Simpson-Smith read from Nobel laureate Czeslaw Milosz's work, The Poem Dedication. Yuri Herrera read The Eclipse by Alberto Monterroso in Spanish, because, as we all know, he said, the United States is a Spanish-speaking country. Michael Allen Zell read from Václav Havel, while Zachary Lazar offered resilience in the form of an Allen Ginsberg poem. There was a poem about Eric Garner read by Brad Richard, Yasmin Bey's Thoughts About Bataclan and Tamir Rice read by Christina Robinson, and excerpts from Guantanamo Diary read by Mahama Medu Utslali read by Ambata Kazinans. Feminist writers were well represented. Elizabeth Gross read from Audre Lorde's Uses of the Erotic, and Kelly Harris DeBerry brought the house down with her reading of June Jordan's poem About My Rights. I love Stacey Balkan's reading of surrealist artist Merritt Oppenheim's Nobody Will Give You Freedom, You Have to Take It. For me, the most memorable reading of the afternoon was Andy Young and Khaled Hegazi reading Poem of Prohibitions by Ahmed Fuad Nagum, a poem about the triumph of love in the face of prohibition. It was about love singing its heart out, love that could not be outlawed, and the end result of that reading was love and poetry bringing us together. All afternoon, life flowed around the open space. Sirens screamed past on St. Claude Avenue. Children were playing at different spots around the room. The hum of conversations rose from the sidewalk outside. Passersby stopped to see what was going on and came on in. Starting with organizers Jamie Attenberg and Adrian Van Young, it took a village to make this magic. Donors of space, time, refreshments, energy. It was a gift, and it was a generous one. All of these writers giving of their best selves to celebrate the inspiration found in another writer's work. It had a New Orleans spin, to be sure, but it's good to remember that at the same time, the same day, events were taking place all over the country, from the steps of the New York Public Library to our own art garage. All over the country, people were being reminded of what literature can do: inspire, console, unify, energize. And no one felt alone. Everyone felt connected. Everyone felt alive. You'll find the reading list for Writers Resist on our WWNO.org website. Seek it out for inspiration. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Tim Gotro reads from and signs Signals, New and Selected Stories, Tuesday, January 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. C.W. Cannon launches his new book, French Quarter Beautification Project, January 28th at 5 at the Dance Quarter, 1719 Toledano Street. Dr. Bulent Alazira, Director and Senior Associate of the Turkey Project, Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., discusses crisis in Turkey, internal strife, and external difficulties, Monday, January 30th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. This meeting is presented by the World Affairs Council of New Orleans. Today's guest, Colleen Mooney, hosts the first meeting of Sisters in Crime, a national organization that promotes the advancement, recognition, and professional development of women crime writers, Tuesday, January 31st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And coming up, Room 220 presents poet Dr. Jerry Ward, whose new book is Fractal Song, and storyteller El Casimu Harris. That's Thursday, February 2nd at 7 at the Antenna Gallery on St. Claude Avenue. And coming up February 4th, the Historic New Orleans Collection presents the 22nd Annual Williams Research Center Symposium, Storyville and Jazz, 1917. The all-day event takes place at the Hotel Monteleone and features talks about Storyville and Jazz by such well-known figures as Ted Widmer, Alicia Long, David Sacre, John Lawrence, Jeff Rosenheim, Bruce Boyd Rayburn, Greg Lambusi, Rachel Lyons, Karen Armacost, Ron Rona, and Dr. Michael White. The evening before, Friday, February 3rd, Pamela Arsenault discusses her new book, Guidebooks to Sin, at a lecture at 5:30 at the Hotel Monteleone Queen Anne Ballroom, followed by a reception and book signing at 6:30 at the Historic New Orleans Collection, 533 Royal Street. The lecture is free. The symposium has an admission charge. Check out hnoc.org for information. The Living Library Program, The Power of Your Story, sponsored by Tulane University's Howard Tilton Library, was originally scheduled for January 26th through 28th. It's been rescheduled for March 17th through 19th. Here's how it works. Individuals volunteer to be books, and attendees become readers who check out a book, meaning they sit with the volunteer to hear their story. If you'd like to volunteer to tell your story, check out LibGuides, that's LibGuides, tulane.edu/livinglibrary. If you're a student who's a fan of Jane Austen, consider entering the 2017 Jane Austen Society of North America's Essay Contest, which invites you to submit short essays that address imagining film or stage adaptations of Austen's work. Prizes are generous, and the deadline is May 21st, 2017. For more information, visit the Essay Contest page at JASNA, J-A-S-N-A, .org. And a big shout out to Michael Tisserand, whose Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White, is a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award in Biography. The awards will be announced March 16th. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.